supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
From the glass-enclosed studios of WHYY in Philadelphia, it's time for another well-ventilated hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Just what can you accomplish with a greenhouse? On today's show, we'll explain the big difference between freestanding and attached and the types of tricks any greenhouse will do best. Otherwise, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, that's right. Potential guests are busy hoarding heat and mats, so we will take that heap and help it. Of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and meanderingly mischievous miscommunications. So don't dare diddle with that dial. It's all coming up, like you harvesting a seemingly endless supply of out-of-season salad greens as long as the non-summer sun keeps shining, right after this. Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, I can't believe we've never done a full question of the week on greenhouses. They are addictive. They are fun. They are the PhD level of gardening. But you also have to know their limitations. We'll talk about the pluses and the minuses when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, though, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know we're taking that heap and helping. At 1-888-346-9499. Alex, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
Hey, it's good to have you here, Alex. Where are you?
I'm in Waco, Texas.
All right. Always nice to hear from our friends there. One of the first stations to pick us up many, many years ago. What can we do for you, Alex?
Well, I had a few questions about a ficus tree that I have.
Right. An indoor fig, I presume?
Yeah, that's correct. We've had it for a long time, 10 years or so, maybe, and it's getting big. And I just need to know a little bit about how to care for it. How to fertilize it correctly. I've had some issues in the past, trying different products and how I should cut it back, to maybe control its growth a little bit.
Well, you know, there are many types of ficus. The classic is the big leafed so-called rubber plant, which is in the ficus family. All of these are figs, but non-fruiting figs that are generally grown for indoor use. I can tell just by the tone of the conversation that you're overfeeding it, because I've never heard anyone else ever talk about feeding a ficus. These are practically air plants. Many of them, it is not unusual to have a ficus in an office or home situation for 10, 20, 30 years that's never been fed, and it's absolutely fine. Their enemies are overwatering.
Okay.
Light that is too bright. These indoor plants have been bred to get by in the filtered light, the dappled light that is the standard in most homes, which is one reason why these are considered relatively indestructible plants. They're not as bulletproof as a snake plant, for instance, or a spider plant, but they're pretty close. And the bad news I have to tell you is as a ficus ages, it is not unusual to have the lower leaves drop off just out of old age, just like us. And I'm presuming that's what's happening, is it's getting a little leggy, perhaps not from lack of light, but simply because you've lost some of the lower leaves to age.
I think we have lost a few of the lower leaves. And I just didn't know whether, you know, I really have never pruned it at all, and didn't know if that's something maybe I should be doing to, I don't know, just dress it up a little bit,
no,
or if it just needs to continue to bush out.
I'm glad to hear that you haven't pruned it, because, again, that's not anything anyone ever does. I don't know what you've been feeding it, and you know what? I'm not going to ask you. So we're going to stay friends on that level.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, if you are a fuss budget, And I could only imagine that you could only be a medium fuss budget, or you would have killed this thing by paying too much attention to it at this point. If you must do something, put it into a slightly taller pot.
Okay.
Not necessarily a bigger pot, but drop the base of the plant into a taller pot. And then, because you do have some legginess, right? You do have an open area at the bottom where the leaves have simply died of old age.
I do, and it has a fairly substantial root structure above the soil.
That's great.
As well,
that's great. What you can do then is you can get a pot that's a little taller, and you can add like an inch or two of compost, yard waste compost, to the top of the pot. You've already got the roots there, so that's no problem whatsoever. It won't hurt them at all to have soil around them, and it will make the same plant appear less leggy. And that's a really sleazy trick I learned at a botanical garden once, is you just move the pot higher, so to speak, in the field of view, so you don't have to layer the plant and try to eliminate the center, which can get tricky and generally kills the plant. But every year, if you can find a slightly taller pot, or even extend your pot if you're clever, you know, make it higher with something you'd cobble together in the basement, you can add an inch or two of fresh compost at the top every year. And, you know, the height of the plant will not change, but the fullness will appear to be much fuller.
Right.
But it sounds like you have a perfectly normal, very happy ficus. Don't prune it. Back off on any kind of feeding you're doing. And make your feeding structural. Like I said, get at least once, get that taller pot, fill in the top with compost. The fig will love that natural fertilizer, and it'll get rid of some of that stalk view you're getting.
Okay.
All right, man?
Great.
All right, Alex. Good luck.
Well, hey, thanks, Mike.
Take care.
You too.
1-888-346-9499. Hong, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. Hong, how are you?
Okay.
Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes.
And can I ask what derivation that is? Where's the name from? Where are you originally from?
China.
Oh, okay. Very good. Where are you now?
Jenkintown area?
Jenkintown. That's a heck of a commute, isn't it? Yeah. All right. What can we do for you, Hong?
I'm trying to learn when would be a good time to remove poison ivy.
And do you have poison ivy in your backyard or climbing up your trees or something?
Nearby.
Well, right now it's starting to get tricky. Poison ivy is kind of what we call a herbaceous perennial. It dies mostly back to the ground. If you got really keen eyes and you don't have a lot of birds, you can identify it by the berries it forms. But by this time of year, quite honestly, birds love those berries, and they're eating them, and they're depositing those berries in different places, which is why you can never get rid of poison ivy completely. Because even though you can get every plant in your plot, so to speak, the birds are always planting anew. Now, do you know what the poison ivy looks like? Have you learned to identify it?
Yeah, I think so, with the leaves.
Right, exactly. Very tricky at this time of year. And quite honestly, too miserable to be outside doing this kind of work. At this time of year, I don't want to be pulling any kind of weeds. And the nice thing about it is it's not getting any bigger right now. It's not going to be growing. It's just dormant over the winter time. So over the winter, I would suggest you double check, go online, look at some websites, look at some photos of the poison ivy. And one thing to remember is it really is true. It's always three leaves. There's a notorious local weed that has the exact same vining habit, except it has five leaves.
Right.
It's called Virginia creeper.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of people, you know, act like it's poison ivy because it looks so similar. But there's really nothing, unless you're like me and you're growing raspberries, which oddly enough, when they're young, they look a little bit like poison ivy. There's nothing around you're going to confuse it with. So over the winter, be saving all your heavy plastic shopping bags, not the thin ones from the supermarket, but like the good ones from the mall store, those really heavy plastic, high quality ones.
Okay.
And then in the spring, when everything starts to green up again and you can identify the poison ivy, what you want is a big supply of those shopping bags, a helper, a rolling trash can, and a hose. And you go to the plant, you see the plant in the ground, you soak the base of the vine with your hose until the soil is saturated. You slide one of the bags on each arm, covering both hands. And then with one hand, you grasp the vine very carefully down at the soil line, and you tug gently. And if it doesn't come out right away, now your helper's doing all the work. Now they saturate that soil some more. Some people will just leave the hose running at the base of the plant as they're doing this, because water is a great helper in getting poison ivy out. When you pull it slowly, pull it gently, the entire root will come out. And it may shock you. If it's an older plant, it may come up out of the ground and start traveling. You'll have to follow it for a while. But this is good because it means you're getting the entire root. And then when you get to the end and that comes out, you'll see the root hairs. So then you know you got it all. So you use the one bag covered hand that you haven't pulled with to pull the plastic bag over top of the poison ivy. Then you put both plastic bags with the poison ivy in the middle into the trash can, get two fresh bags, and you move on to the next plant. I cleared my 1,000-square-foot gardening area completely when I first started, which was totally overgrown with poison ivy, in one afternoon, and I didn't get any on me. But when you do the plastic bag trick, the work goes fast, and even the most sensitive people don't get any of the oil on them. And then when you're done, just wash up real well with cold water. No soap, no wash rag, no special poison ivy dissolving substance, just cold water. And if you think you touched something after you had poison ivy on something, just wipe it down real well with cold water and then wash that washcloth by itself in cold water. Cold water dissolves the oil completely.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Hong.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and urge everyone with pansies outside to collect some discarded Christmas trees. Cut the branches off that useless trunk and use the springy evergreen boughs to protect those otherwise winter-loving flowers from the crushing weight of ice and snow. But don't you go saying, hey, who changed the climate again just yet? Because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to get the most out of a greenhouse. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, many are the joys and many are the pitfalls of greenhouses. We'll talk about them both when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, John. How are you?
I'm well, thanks, and I'm in Ardmore, Pennsylvania.
Very good. You know the drill. What can we do for John in beautiful Ardmore?
I have a sod question.
Okay.
My lawn was burned out over the summer, and I had, in late August, sod installed, and the landscaper said, water it heavily, and don't cut it till it grows out and has a nice, healthy look to it.
Right. That makes sense.
I did all that. I mean, I watered it, and it grew and grew and grew, and it's gorgeous, but I did not cut it.
Oh, how tall is it?
10 inches.
Yikes. Yikes. Double yikes. One of the issues, I know a lot of people don't understand why lawns would need to be cut. But these are grasses that are not native to our area that have really been bred to be a certain height. No grasses, no lawn grasses are native to the United States. The grasses you're growing in Ardmore, by definition, because they were put in the fall. They're cool season grasses. They're Kentucky bluegrass or the fescues. And these were meant to be kept at a height of about 3 inches. More importantly, and more to the point, if your 10-inch grass is covered with snow and ice and pressed down and smothered, it will develop a condition called snow mold, which is quite nasty. So do you think, now, I guess the problem is, by definition, any cutting you do now is going to remove over half of the leaf. How high can you get a lawnmower, man? Can you?
Well, that was the question. I had the landscaper said that he had a commercial mower which went a lot higher than the my home mower.
I like that.
And so the question was whether or not I should have him do it now.
Yes.
Or wait until the spring. But you're saying do it now.
Oh yes, yes. It would not be unusual for a landscaper in this part of the country to be less familiar with snow mold and the associated dangers of having a lawn that is excessively high in the winter. But some of my lawn care advice comes from Paul Tukey, who is a lawn care expert, wrote the Organic Lawn Care Manual, and he's lived his entire life in New England. And this is a guy with deathly fear of snow mold. He's seen it so many times. He used to be in the landscaping business himself. He helps people grow lawns organically now. And the colder the climate, the more important it is not to have a close-cut lawn, because that can be burnt by severe cold. That can be damaged without enough of a top layer. But I love the fact that you have access to like a cartoon lawnmower that can go up kind of on springs. I would say to, if you can afford this, if you can get the timing in, if it truly is 10 inches, I would take it down to 6 inches. I would wait a week or 10 days, and then I would take it down to 3 or 4 inches. But okay, Now's the time to fix it. You still have time.
And the fact that we're running at 20 degrees during the day is not a factor?
No, it would be in the reverse. It would be if this was 110 heat wave in the summer. You could not cut that lawn. I would beg you not to touch it because it would release all the stored moisture. Right now, that lawn should be dormant. The only thing you'll be doing by giving it a haircut is removing the part that could mat down. And instead of acting like grass, it would be like a tarp on top of your grass. And it would smother vast sections.
Right. I got it.
All right,
well,
man.
That's terrific.
All right.
That's what I'll do.
Good luck.
Thank you, Mike.
1-888-346-9499. Larry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Larry. Where are you?
Cape Cod.
Oh, right, up in New England. Going to get chilly there this winter, isn't it?
Just like every winter.
Yeah. All right, what can we do for you, sir?
Well, my question is twofold, and it's regarding cannas or canna lilies.
Right.
My wife thinks it's cannas. I think it's canna lilies that people just shorten. First off, who's right on this?
I'd say you're both right.
Yeah.
Canna is the proper common name of the plant, just the word C-A-N-N-A. But for some reason, they picked up the term lily somewhere down the line. So I'm not sure I've ever seen these summer bloomers listed in catalogs where they weren't called canna lilies. Neither term is botanically correct. But when you want to be botanically correct, you got to be really good with the Latin, which, you know, despite 12 years of Catholic education, I never was. But nobody would slap you around for either wording. So, you know, call that one dead even.
Okay, that's good. So my question regarding them is, how to care for them pulling up the tubers out of the ground. What do I do with them over the winter? Because I'm 3 years running of killing the tubers. 1 year I didn't clean them good enough, the dirt, so they rotted out. The next year I really cleaned them good and dried them out. And then the third year I got some fuzzy mold growing on them and nothing came of them. So I got to buy new ones every year. And, you know, at the end of the year there's a ton of them. They're huge and I'd love to be able to keep them and grow them. And what do I do?
So you're having great success with the plants themselves over the course of the summer. Obviously,
if
your rhizomes are getting big and actually splitting, then you're getting lots of flowers all summer long.
Oh, a ton of flowers. They're gorgeous, yeah.
Yeah, so they're getting a lot of sun. They're happy where they are. And they're still in the ground now.
They still are, yeah.
Have you, is the above ground growth still standing? Did you cut that back?
It is still standing. I actually cut a couple of them back down to the ground, and I left a few others still up. But, yeah, the cold weather has really, you know, knocked them down.
Typically, if you're going to leave these things in the ground, you leave the top parts there, because that way you're certainly not removing anything above the crown, and you got that much more on top of the plant. But are they in a big open location? Is there any chance they're, like, planted next to the house or something?
Yeah, they're ringing the deck off the back of the house.
You know, Cape Cod, are you near the water, or do you have any kind of mild effect because of where you are?
Well, Cape Cod, everybody's near the water, but, you know, we're certainly not on the water. But we'll get a couple of cold snaps down into the 20s and teens, but generally we are, you know, upper 30s. To 40 degrees for an average.
And when you've been digging these up before, what have you been doing with them? What did you physically do? Did you pack them in anything? Where did you store them?
No, I didn't pack them in. I put them in a paper bag, left them on the bulkhead stairs, so they're kind of outside, kind of protected.
Mm-hmm.
Then those rotted out because I didn't clean the dirt off good enough. The next year, I cleaned them good and dried them out in the basement, which is running a dehumidifier, which I guess worked a little too well. And that, again, just in a paper bag. And then I kept them in plastic containers on the bulkhead stairs again, and that's what I got the mold growth, fuzzy mold growth from.
Yeah, I don't like any of that, so that's so far so good.
Okay.
What most people do who store them is they will dig them up. Never clean them when you dig them up. You're not getting mold or rot because of any dirt you left on them. You're getting mold and rot from having cleaned them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, leave as much dirt on them as you can. And then if the ground was moist when you harvested them, I would not add any more moisture, but I would pack them in a cardboard box in the center of a box filled with peat moss or sand. And then I would put that box somewhere that's going to stay between 40 and 50 degrees.
Okay.
And I think you would get good survival that way. Certainly better than anything you've done so far.
Yeah.
If it's a little dry when you're harvesting, some people would spritz the top of the peat moss and then just close the box lightly. You know how you fold cardboard closed as opposed to sealing it closed?
Yeah.
Because you want it to breathe. And that's what the peat moss and the sand will do. It'll insulate, it'll keep moisture in the roots, but it also won't keep too much in. It'll still allow air to pass back and forth. Yeah, I wouldn't keep them next to a dehumidifier or anything like that. That's asking for trouble. I wouldn't try to store them outside or in a normal heated part of the house. This is like a heated garage basement kind of thing. But I want you to leave a couple of the ones outside that are outside. Pick a couple that you haven't cut the top growth back on yet.
Okay.
And what I want you to do is shred up a whole bunch of leaves. And I want you to put like 3, 4, 5 inches of shredded leaves around those standing up top parts of the plant.
Okay.
And just leave them alone. And
but don't cut them at all. Just leave them standing upright.
Those top stakes, those dead plant parts that are sticking up in the air, will keep the mulch in place better. They'll hold snow cover better. And you're not doing anything to limit the amount of material on the crown. You don't want to expose the crown and leave them outside.
Okay.
Take the ones that you cut back, dig those up and store them exactly the way I said. Leave the ones that are still standing outside heavily mulched with shredded leaves. They got to be shredded with a lawnmower or a leaf blower sent on reverse.
Yep.
And then in the spring, when all threat of frost is passed, just move the leaf cover out of the way and cut off the top part of the old dead growth, but still leave about 6 inches coming up of the old dead plant part. And then I would not be surprised if we didn't get new green growth coming up out of the ground from those mulched ones.
Okay. Great.
And then your success or failure rate will tell you what to do for sure the following year.
Yeah, right. Okay, excellent.
All right, man?
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right. Good luck to Larry and his cannas.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Saul, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm very
good. I listened to your program, and this is the first, and I'm a first-time caller.
Excellent. Where are you, Saul?
I'm in Wynwood, Pennsylvania. I live in Wynwood, Pennsylvania.
May I say that you don't sound like a native Wynwoodian?
Correct. I was born in South Africa and came to this area about 35 years ago, yeah.
And good. I'm glad you didn't pick up the Philadelphia accent. It's not nearly as charming.
Okay.
What can we do for Saul?
Well, Saul, over the last couple of years, has had a lot of trouble growing a nice lawn. He has quite a few Japanese maple trees, which we planted when we originally built the house here, and they've grown into quite large trees now. And what happens, we seed the lawn, fertilize it, they put straw on, and come springtime, we have a really nice lawn. And then by the time, and I'm good about watering it and doing all the necessary cutting and trying not to cut it too short, and then comes late summer and early fall, and they're huge patches of sort of very, very scraggly lawn.
Mm-hmm.
So the gardener said that he was going to seed the lawn for me, and he's wanting to do it now, and I sort of feel that it's a bit late.
It's very late. Yeah, that would be a waste of money. The soil is, boy, I tell you, man, the soil froze earlier this week. I barely got some of my plants out of the ground in time. This was a brutally fast winter. The ideal time for you to overseed your lawn is August 15th to September 15th. And anything else, especially in your situation, is going to be a waste of time.
But tell me, when they turn up the soil, seed, fertilize, they put straw down.
I have never understood two things you just said, which are relatively universal in some lawn care specialists, which is feeding a seed. A seed is 90% food. All the fertilizer does is burn up some of the seed. You never pour. It's like pouring salt on the seeds. All you do is...
I didn't know that.
Most people don't, but the professionals should. They know that a seed is maybe 2% genetic material, and the rest is protection and food for the young plant. So fertilizer just reduces the germination rate, and then I never understood this American obsession with smothering the new grass with this straw. I've been told the excuse is it's keeping moisture in the soil, but the negative impact, especially if there's any seed heads left in the straw, are enormous. But your big enemy is those trees, and not in the ways that you're thinking. Yes, their leaves have to be removed from a lawn, or at least shredded, or they're going to smother the lawn. And yes, the shade is very limiting on the types of grass you can grow. But what most people neglect is the tremendous competition for food and moisture. Maples are notoriously thirsty trees.
Right.
I would recommend, if your maples are mature, do you ever have moss growing there?
Yes.
I would investigate the idea in the springtime of tilling up the soil and cultivating a moss lawn. In your situation with those maple trees, the moss will thrive. It'll be green all year long. There are mosses that will take some foot traffic. They thrive in the shade. All you have to do is keep the soil acidic. They never need to be fed. They never need to be cut. They may need to be watered during a...
Wow, that sounds like a really good idea.
And you're in Pennsylvania. So I would urge you to go to a website, Moss Acres.
Yes.
They are actually a sod farm for moss that's up in the Poconos somewhere. And they sell moss as if it were lawn sod that you can cut up and the moss will spread to fill in the bare spots. They also sell publications and advice on how to cultivate a lawn out of your own moss. But their website will give you everything you need. You are in a perfect situation to have a lawn that's green all year long and never needs any care from you.
Thank you very, very much.
All right,
Saul. You've been most helpful and you've saved me a lot of money.
Excellent. That's what we love to do, man.
Thank you very, very much indeed. Take care, okay?
You too, sir.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all of you garden gnomes who reside in areas outside of our city of brotherly love that we Philelphians are proud to host the world's biggest indoor flower show every spring, and that a solid third of those who enjoy the extravagant displays come from outside our area. This year's Philadelphia International Flower Show will be held March 4th to the 11th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philly. The theme, a visit to Hawaii without the jet lag. Unless you're coming in from California, of course, and you should. But don't you go lining up airfare and accommodations just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and what a greenhouse can and can't do for gardeners in cold climes. I'm Chilly Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Greenhouses are fun, entertaining, they're addictive, but what do they really do, and what are their limitations? We'll tell you what they're capable of and what you have to watch out for when we get to the question of the week, after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Mary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Mary. How are you?
I'm pretty good today.
And where is Mary pretty good?
I'm in Moab, Utah.
Ooh, that's a different climate than the one I garden in.
Yeah.
And so what's going on in Utah?
Well, right now I have a gopher problem.
Oh, I'll bet you do.
And it's sort of like Caddyshack in my garden this winter.
You have the most difficult to handle burrowing nuisance animal in all of agriculture. People where I live have groundhogs, which some people call woodchucks, and they think these creatures are like the bane of their existence. If there was a hit list, a gardener's most despised list of burrowing mammals, I think gophers would be 1 through 5.
Oh, lucky me, or lucky us, I guess. There's a lot of people with this problem.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you right now that if you're frustrated by it, you've tried a lot of things, nothing seems to be working, there's nothing wrong with you.
Well, you know, I can trap them, and but, you know, it's like killing these small, furry little things is sort of, it goes against my nature, you know.
No, I hear you. It's not like they're true vermin. It's not like they're mice and rats that, you know, are out to get us. You know,
they're just doing what they do, and it's their job.
But now, are they getting into your vegetable garden? Is that the
can? They're in the ornamentals right now. You know, they'll get into my garlic in the winter, and, you know, the patch, it will be totally disturbed by spring.
So. Right, so they won't eat it because garlic is pretty much a repellent.
But no, they don't eat it, but they
unearth it.
They definitely mess it up, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a very typical of these creatures who have very expansive underground burrows. And so far, the most successful thing you've done is non-live traps.
Non-live traps.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Now, I'm going to give you a resource.
Okay.
This is the best advice I know for gophers. Now, you have to understand, I've never had this problem. I've never really even seen it when I've been visiting other parts of the country. I know about it. I know to take it seriously. I know it is right at the top end of gardening problems, very similar to what we in the Northeast have to deal with deer. Here's the resource. There is a great common sense pest control organization on the West Coast called the BIRC. I want you to write those four letters down. BIRC, the Biointegral Resource Center. But you don't need to remember that. Just BIRC, and they're on the web at BIRC.org. They've been around for like 30 years. They publish two professional journals. One is called the IPM Practitioner, Integrated Pest Management, which is all the different levels of controlling problem animals and insects. And the other is Common Sense Pest Control. I don't recall exactly which publication, but they did an entire issue of one on all of the known gopher controls.
Oh, okay.
And it is concentrated cream of information. I mean, every part of it is going to be informative to you, but you will be able to match your situation, your physical layout, your plantings, your needs, your feelings about these creatures with the Well, with the correct controls, because it sounds like you've found a way to control them, but it's unpleasant to you, which is which is great. I mean, in one sense, because you're trying to reach a little further. You're trying to become a better gardener. So, and I know there is a system of trenching that has been proven very effective with gopher control. But this is something where you want to go online, go to the BIRC, and I guarantee that there'll be dozens of good ideas for you in there, much better than anything I could come up with off the top of my, in this case, with this pest, very ignorant head, because I've never had to deal with it. But I know the editor of the journals, Bill Quarles, takes gophers very seriously and researched this special issue on gophers tremendously. So I absolutely guarantee you'll find it worth your time and money.
Okay. Good deal.
All right. Sorry it's not a more direct answer, but I know my limitations. and I know that if I had this problem, this is the resource I would use.
Okay. Thanks so much.
All right. Good luck, Mayor.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Frank, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
How you doing?
I have a little problem I'd like to try and get your guidance and suggestions on.
All right, Frank, where are you calling from?
About 15 miles north of Allentown.
Okay, 15 miles north of Allentown.
You're Pennsylvania. Gonna
make, you're gonna, I know where Allentown. Well, actually, I think there's an Allentown in New York as well. That's not as far as Scranton-Wilkesboro.
No.
So where are you, Frank?
Halfway between Philly and Scranton-Wilkesboro. How's that?
Okay, well, Frank, in an undisclosed location, man of secrets. Maybe we'll find out why when he asks his question. What's going on?
Well, we have municipal baseball fields, and I'm a little disturbed of having to have my children play there because I consider it a toxic wasteland along with their seed and feed and weed and feed programs and the chemical fertilizers and the grub control that they put on. It's not something I want my children crawling around on this grass.
Well, you astonish me, Frank, because I was a coach in the Lehigh Valley for my son's teams for many, many years, and none of these municipalities wasted money on lawn chemicals. Now, we were not in any kind of, you know, once you get into the high school and college level, you do have these requirements that the grass be a certain height and that the fields meet the state or, you know, whatever the organizing body is, the requirements of them. But you're not talking about that kind of situation, are you?
No, we're talking about little leaguers.
Yeah. Well, the first thing you want to do is go in to the first council meeting you can and say, do you realize how much money we could save here? These chemicals are absolutely unnecessary. This is what you tell them. Tell them you went and you talked to an expert, and here's the deal.
That's you, right?
Well, it's Pat. I play one on TV. Yeah. Tell them to cut the grass as high as they are willing to. I know the requirements for Major League ball and AAA and everything are like an inch and a quarter tops, but you can certainly play on 2.5 to 3 inches. And not only will the game go just as well, it won't hurt nearly as much when the kids go down.
I agree with that.
The slightly higher the grass, the springier it is, the better it is for them. So the first thing they need to do is cut it at a reasonable height. Make sure the mowers are returning the clippings to the lawn, because that's most of the nutrition a lawn needs. Make sure they don't do any seeding in the spring. Again, total waste of money. Make sure they don't do any feeding or overseeding in the summer. A total waste of money. The time to work on a lawn in your area is in the fall. That's when you repair bare spots. That's when you put down seed. If there is municipal compost available where you are, tell them to try a feeding. Tell them, you know, you may think I'm nuts, but spread an inch of compost on this field in September. And then when spring comes around, you tell me if you don't think it looks better than a chemical feeding. And I guarantee it will. And the grubs, you probably don't even have grubs. But if you do have grubs, a single application of milky spore powder to the soil in the late summer when the grubs are feeding will make that ball field grub-free for 30 years. Their GrubX, their chemical grub controls, they only work for one season. The milky spore costs the same. You put it down once. You put it down at the right time of year. And as long as there are grubs in your turf, which I doubt you have, they'll eat it. They'll breed this natural disease in the soil, and no grubs will be able to live there again.
Yeah. How about the use of we have many trees around these fields, and it's a big problem to collect these leaves and cart them off every fall. Would you have a use for them?
If the leaves can be blown or raked onto the grass itself after the season is over in the fall, and they can be shredded with lawnmowers right into the turf until there's no longer any whole leaves visible, that's a fall feeding.
That's what I like to hear, Mike.
And thank you, by the way, Frank. Thank you for paying attention. I got to tell you that obviously my entire life here has been to try to limit the use of these agricultural chemicals, especially in an ornamental setting, like on lawns. But today, I mean, with the financial crises facing every municipality, it's a sin for something like this to be where they're wasting their money. So you should have a real two-pronged battle here. If they won't go for safety, talk dollars. Talk dollars in their pocket and hours they're not spending spreading this stuff.
It sounds good to me.
All right, good luck, Frank.
I'll get back to you and let you know how it turns out.
We will be waiting to hear.
Thank you.
All right, good luck, man.
Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Greenhouse Gardening 101. We start off with Robert in Elkton, Maryland, who writes, I've been considering getting a hobby greenhouse for my backyard. Do you have any recommendations as to type or features? Wayne in Phoenixville, PA, has a similar questione. He writes, I searched your website and couldn't find your thoughts on backyard greenhouses. It seems that they could give you a few extra months of growing time in a semi-controlled environment. What are your thoughts, tips, and concerns? Thanks. Well, thank you, Wayne. I couldn't believe we didn't have a full-fledged greenhouse discussion up in the A to Z archives, but you are indeed correct, and I will correct that lack of information under the letter G right now. There are, of course, many different types of hobby greenhouses, but to me, one of the most important differences is attached versus freestanding. If you have a south or east-facing portion of your home that could accept the addition of a greenhouse-like structure, I would strongly suggest you consider it, especially in the north, where supplemental heating is going to be a major issue. Now, let's say your home has a brick or stone wall you can use for the backside of that greenhouse. The sun would heat that wall during the day and radiate it back into the greenhouse at night. If everything is facing the correct direction, this could be a monster amount of free passive heat. And you wouldn't need to connect the structures with a costly walkthrough. The greenhouse door can just be on the greenhouse itself. Freestanding greenhouses are much more challenging to keep warm. As I learned when we built one at the bottom of my driveway during the time my magazine Organic Gardening was mounting major displays in the Philadelphia Flower Show. Because it was freestanding, we had to do everything we could to conserve energy and reduce costs, like venting the hot air from our electric clothes dryer into the greenhouse through a system of well-insulated pipes. And then we did all our clothes drying late at night when the need for winter heat was the greatest. But warning, you can't do this with a gas dryer. It's just not safe. I also had read a fabulous study that found the root zone temperature of greenhouse plants to be much more important to their survival during cold weather than the actual air temperature inside the greenhouse. So the entire bench on which my plants sat in the center of the greenhouse was covered with a very heavy-duty heating mat system that kept those little rootsies warm at night, and it was much less costly than trying to heat the air. And because any hot air naturally rises to the top of a greenhouse's peaked roof, we installed powerful fans to keep pushing that warm air back down to where the plants were. It turned out that the air circulation the fans were providing was just as helpful in its own right in preventing disease. But I tell you, on really cold nights, I still had to turn on one of those oil-filled portable radiators inside the greenhouse, which I probably would not have had to do or do nearly as often if I had the insulating wall of a house helping out. But equally important as creating heat on a cold night is having an automatic method for releasing too much heat on a sunny day. You would be amazed at how hot a well-sealed greenhouse can get in the middle of winter if it's getting full sun. And of course, during the warmer days of spring and fall, that heat can build up rapidly, making an automatic vent an absolute necessity. These are typically a panel in the roof or at the top of one of the peaks that opens up when the temperature triggers a gas-filled cartridge to expand and push out a little arm that opens the vent. Doesn't need any electric. It's not wired. It's a passive automaton. Although you'd need a real exhaust fan as well if you live in the South and or hope to use the greenhouse during the warmer months. So Wayne in Phoenixville really hit it right on the head. A greenhouse can typically get you started a couple months early and protect tender summer plants for a few months longer at the end of the season. There's no better way to start your seeds and or coax small plants up to a bigger size before planting them out in the spring, or to ripen up those last runs of peppers and such in the fall. In most climates, a greenhouse is also ideal for growing lettuce, spinach, and other cool weather crops right through the winter. In my part of Pennsylvania, which is about an hour colder than Wayne's part, it would be a perfect place to overwinter plants like rosemary that are just shy of being cold hardy enough to make it outdoors here. But the further north you are, the more expensive it's going to be to keep tender plants alive all winter. And summertime in almost all areas is when a greenhouse rests, with the inside just too hot for anything, even with the door propped open and the vent at full mast. Besides, it's summer. Get outside. Blow the stink off yourself. Greenhouses are fun and addictive. They are the PhD level of gardening. Don't skimp on the door. It's where you can lose a lot of heat in the winter. Give yourself a full season or two to learn how to make the best use of your new friend. Give a lot of thought to placement and construction, and you'll have a place to garden when other gardeners are trapped inside until spring. Well, that sure was some fun information about getting involved with a greenhouse now, wasn't it? Luckily, yous can review the question of the week in print at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to shut down my automatic vent if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. please tell us where you live. Put the actual subject in the subject line and check first to see if your answer is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of garden answers. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin Griffin. Rich Banowitz is our webmaster. Sarah Schuhart is his faithful internet companion. Our intern is Jessica Mandick. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Al Banks is our editor. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I am stone out of jokes for the close this week, kids. But I'll turn up my heating mats and come up with a fresh batch next week. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll ring in the new year by listening back to some of our most fabulous calls from past shows. It's condensed cream of You Bet Your Garden.